Rapids Gazette for this Saturday, June 13th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. We take a look at today's front page of Cedar Rapids Gazette. Cedar Rapids commits to Citizens Review Board. This is reported by Kat Russell and Grace King. Citizens soon will have the chance to review police conduct, Cedar Rapids officials announced Friday, though details of the panel's makeup and powers are yet unknown. That there would be any type of community oversight comes after protest leaders met twice this week with city officials, and as the second large protest in a week will be held today. Cedar Rapids Mayor Brad Hart, Police Chief Wayne German, City Manager Jeff Pomerantz, and City Council members Dale Todd and Ashley Vanorni discussed during a 90-minute virtual meeting Friday morning with protest leaders some of the issues protesters have flagged. The groups met in person earlier this week. At a news conference Friday, German listed ways he said the Cedar Rapids Police Department already was ahead on meeting some of the protesters' demands, including its ban on chokeholds, knees to the neck, and the use of vascular restraint. German said he and Hart are dedicated to creating a citizens' review board, but said they first need to do research. German said, "A citizen review board is multifaceted. There's lots of responsibilities that the board has, and there are lots of issues that need to be addressed involving confidentiality requirements, state statutes, civil service statutes. Those need to be worked out, and we're committed to getting it done." There are several citizens review board models used throughout the country, according to the U.S. Department of Justice, and they range in duties and power. Citizen review boards might investigate allegations of police misconduct and recommend findings to the chief or sheriff. In other models, police officers might investigate allegations and develop findings for citizens to review. The citizens would recommend that the chief or sheriff approve or reject them. In some cities, complaints may appeal findings established by the police or sheriff's department to citizens, who review them and then recommend their own findings. And in other cities, an auditor investigates the process by which the police or sheriff's department accepts and investigates complaints and reports on the thoroughness and fairness of the process to the public. It is important, German said, that the type of board Cedar Rapids adopts be the right fit. Hart said, "We are going to investigate the best practices from around the country and come up with the best way to move this forward. There's a variety of options, and that's the work that has to be done. And we're committed to doing that and doing it quickly." The mayor added, "We're starting from a really good, strong spot. We're starting with an accredited police department that has a lot of policies already in place that many communities across the country don't have. Iowa City has a community police review board that issues its advisory findings to the city council. Critics say the board is powerless." Talks Friday morning between Cedar Rapids officials and protest leaders took on, quote, "a marked difference in tone," unquote, said Stacy Walker, a Linn County supervisor who said he is one of those representing the protesters. Walker said, "Officials seemed more open, willing to play ball, which I appreciated. Hopefully this change in approach will last and we can get through these negotiations." Hart, too, agreed that the conversation went well, saying they worked through only two of several demands because they were having great discussion. "I hope the narrative will not be that there was pushback," Hart said. "Let's be fair to everyone. Let's treat everyone equally. That's the issue behind all of this." Hart said he would be interested in the Iowa legislature making marijuana possession a Class 1 misdemeanor, a lesser misdemeanor, so people in possession of marijuana could be ticketed instead of arrested. That issue was not included in a police reform measure Governor Kim Reynolds signed into law Friday, as lawmakers appear to be preparing to adjourn for the year. The law, though, does speak to two demands of Cedar Rapids protesters, limiting chokeholds and requiring a de-escalation training. Leslie Neely, 31, a Cedar Rapids protest organizer, said the law doesn't go far enough because it still allows chokeholds if a person cannot be captured any other way and if the person has threatened or used deadly force. Neely said, "I think that leaves a large hole in the legislation. It's easy for a police officer to say someone couldn't have been captured any other way." Walker said the bill is a step in the right direction but stops short of a comprehensive police reform, which would include demilitarizing the police force, adding civilian oversight, and redirecting funding for pro-police to support services such as safe and stable housing, food insecurity, and job training. The advocacy group first met with city officials Tuesday, asking them to say yes to their demands and have a plan for how to implement them by Juneteenth, which commemorates the day the last slaves were freed on June 19, 1865 in the United States. On Tuesday, they discussed forming an independent citizens review board and making significant investments in diversity, equality, and inclusion. The advocacy group and city officials are planning to meet again next week to discuss the final three demands: imposing strict body camera provisions, making negotiations between law enforcement and municipal representatives public, and abolishing qualified immunity for officers. Another Cedar Rapids protest will be at 5 p.m. today at Beaver Park. The article is accompanied by a picture of Leslie Neely and Tamara Marcus of Cedar Rapids as they listen during a meeting with Cedar Rapids city officials at the Lynn County Gene Oxley Public Service Center in Cedar Rapids, as both of those organizers are seated in chairs and they are both wearing masks. Another story on the front page: UI will stick with original fall calendar, reported by Vanessa Miller. The University of Iowa will stick with its academic calendar and not follow the lead of the two other state universities in compressing the fall semester. The UI calendar has students coming back to campus August 24, with finals wrapping up the week of June 18. Iowa State University and the University of Northern Iowa this week announced they would move up their fall semester starting date to August 17 and end the semester November 25, before Thanksgiving. The idea behind the compressed schedule was to avoid sending students home over Thanksgiving break and then bringing them back, given the risks associated with travel right now. UI officials announced their decision to stay the course in a campus-wide message Friday. Although UI administrators didn't explain their reasoning for retaining the academic calendar, they committed in the Friday message to closely monitoring COVID-19 cases throughout the fall semester and taking any action deemed necessary to help mitigate the transmission of the virus. In announcing an earlier start and end to the fall semester this week, Iowa State and UNI shared additional coronavirus concern changes planned across campus come August, including social distancing configurations in classrooms, student, faculty, and staff face covering expectations, plexiglass partition additions, and hand sanitation stations. Iowa State also committed to coronavirus testing and contact tracing. UI officials on Friday promised to share more details Wednesday of their policies and recommendations for limiting COVID-19 exposure on campus, followed by forms allowing community members to ask questions. All three of the region universities closed their residence halls and ended on-campus instruction in mid-March, moving instruction online while also canceling work-related travel, in-person meetings, activities, and events, including athletics and graduation ceremonies. Most faculty and staff were told to work from home and only recently started returning, especially those involved in research. The campuses additionally recalled study abroad students from around the globe and canceled those international experiences for spring and summer. Iowa State and UNI have canceled fall study abroad experiences, although the UNI has not done so. UNI on Friday also announced work-related domestic travel will resume Monday. University-sponsored international travel will remain restricted per a Board of Regents travel ban. Iowa State's non-essential travel ban remains in effect. Iowa State also announced this week that its residence halls in the fall will allow only single and double occupancy rooms and will require COVID-19 tests upon arrival for the semester. The campus also will reserve space for students needing to be isolated or quarantined, and it will employ a team of contact tracers to keep any potential coronavirus spread in check. The article is accompanied by a picture of the Currier Residence Hall in Iowa City. On page 2, the Iowa Today page, Cedar Rapids buses to boost capacity Monday, reported by Marissa Payne. City buses will be able to transport more riders Monday when buses begin operating at half capacity, increasing the maximum number of passengers from 10 to 15 per bus. Cedar Rapids transit buses will continue to be operated from 5:15 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday through Friday, with hourly service on all routes except for Route 5, which will run in 15-minute intervals. Weekday peak service and Saturday service remain unavailable, as they have been since May, when service resumed after halting for almost 2 months to curb the spread of coronavirus. Transit manager Brad DeBrower said in a news release, "Many residents have expressed their appreciation for resuming bus service, and riders are following mask requirements, social distancing, and capacity limits." He said daily ridership is slowly increasing, with more trips reaching the 10-passenger capacity, requiring the use of standby buses more frequently. Bus rides still are free. Passengers are asked to continue entering and exiting the bus through the back door. Those with an accessibility issue may enter using the front door. Riders are also required to wear face coverings, masks, bandanas, neck gaiters, and scarves on the bus or in the ground transportation center. Passengers must wait outside the ground transportation center, but will have access to the restrooms and the information booth. The city still encourages riders to limit bus use to essential trips, such as rides to work, the grocery store, or medical appointments. Neighborhood transportation service at Horizons and Linn County Lifts will continue to provide services to fill transportation gaps. The article is accompanied by a picture of a bus and people waiting for the ground at the ground transportation center. And on the same page, we have a COVID-19 update. COVID-19 cases in Iowa top 23,000. Reported by Brooklyn Drazy. COVID-19 cases topped 23,000 in Iowa on Friday, though the number of hospitalizations dropped for the 16th day in a row to 225, the lowest level since April 20. The State Public Health Department reported 381 new positive COVID cases by 11 a.m. Friday, bringing the total to 23,166 in Iowa. Polk County is the first county in Iowa to reach 5,000 cases, with 5,002 people testing positive. 4 deaths were reported Friday, 2 in Polk County, and 1 each in Wapello and Woodbury counties, bringing the total for Iowa to 642. 2 long-term care facilities, Bartles Lutheran Retirement in Bremer County and the Iowa Veterans Home in Marshall County, were removed from the list of facilities with outbreaks, that is, 3 or more confirmed cases of the virus. Edgewood Convalescent Home in Delaware County in northeast Iowa has reported an outbreak. 2 Test Iowa locations in Cedar Rapids and in Des Moines are moving to new locations, the governor's office announced Friday. Over the weekend, the Test Iowa site at Kirkwood Community College will be moving to the Iowa Department of Transportation District Office 6 at 5455 Kirkwood Boulevard Southwest. It will be open Monday. People can receive a free COVID-19 test by registering and getting an appointment at testiowa.com. Also, the Test Iowa site in Des Moines is moving from the Iowa Events Center to Polk County River Place, 2309 Euclid Avenue. On page 3, we have one of the top stories reported by Vanessa Miller. UI hospital workers reject proposal to skip raises, cut pay. The leaders of the union representing thousands of nurses and staffers at University of Iowa hospitals and clinics on Friday overwhelmingly rejected an administrative proposal to eliminate a pay raise scheduled for next month. Specifically, the Service Employees International Union Local 199, which represents about 4,000 frontline UIHC workers, rebuffed a request from the administrators and the Board of Regents to eliminate a 2.1% pay raise the parties negotiated to take effect July 1. Union leadership also rejected the request to cut the members' pay by 10% for 3 months. Board and administrative leaders approached the union May 27 with the request aimed at saving almost $15.6 million to, quote, to offset revenue losses at UIHC due to the COVID-19 related decline in patient visits, unquote, according to an SEIU news release. SEIU leadership reportedly offered a counterproposal that, in return for financial concessions, the UIHC would, quote, reinstate some basic union protections such as a grievance procedure, better communications between the union and management, and increased employee involvement in decision-making at the hospital, unquote. All public unions, save those in public safety, lost significant bargaining powers in 2017 when Iowa lawmakers stripped their rights to bargain for benefits unless employers agree to negotiate those terms. Unfortunately, according to union leadership Friday, the Board of Regents rejected all the union's proposals but still demanded that the union agree to the demand concessions. University of Iowa Healthcare is grappling with a $120 million hit from the COVID-19 and has warned of possible pay cuts, furloughs, unfilled positions, and nixed raises. UIHC employee Don Shanahan called the rejection of the union's counteroffer a slap in the face to all of the frontline healthcare professionals who've been going to work every day during the pandemic. "We've stepped up at every turn, and this is the thanks we get," said Shanahan, who works as an educator at the UIHC Child Behavioral Health Unit. SEIU Local 199 President Kathy Glasson called it unfortunate the Board of Regents thought it appropriate to ask for such huge concessions without offering anything in return. "Their proposal seems counter to their message that we are all in this together," Glasson said. "The good news is that the dedicated healthcare professionals at UIHC can look forward to receiving their much-deserved 2.1% raise thanks to their union contract." In an informal poll of union membership, Glasson told the Gazette many said they were willing to absorb a temporary pay cut so long as it was considered a loan they could get back after revenue rebounded. The union also requested from the administration a commitment of no layoffs during this contract term, but that was shot down, Glasson said. Like its healthcare campus, administrators atop the University of Iowa campus recently announced plans to absorb its tens of millions in COVID losses via furloughs, reassignments, and potential layoffs. Iowa State University also has announced budget cuts and nixed raises, although ISU President Wendy Winterstein in April said unionized workers would get the 2.1% pay raise as specified in their contract. The article is accompanied by a picture of the Service Employees International Union Local 199 President, Kathy Glasson. Now we turn to the insight page for today's Gazette editorial. Iowa Medical Cannabidiol, it's a hard word to pronounce, it's C-A-N-N-A-B-I-D-I-O-L, Cannabidiol Law, is anti-business, anti-healthcare. Iowa's Medical Cannabidiol Law, or program, is in tatters, and Republican legislators just ripped another hole in it. It has been called the worst medical cannabis program in the United States, covering a relatively short list of conditions and imposing extreme restrictions on the types of medicine Iowans are allowed to obtain. Under a bill recently approved by the Republican-controlled Iowa legislature, thousands of Iowans could be cut off from the treatment they need. One of the biggest problems with Iowa's cannabidiol law is that the cap on tetrahydrocannabidiol, or THC, a compound in marijuana that makes users high but also has therapeutic benefits, is far too low. But House File 2589 would make it even worse by replacing the existing 3% cap on THC with a monthly 4.5-gram limit for each patient. More than 2,000 Iowans in the medical cannabis program would be forced to reduce their legal THC consumption, according to figures circulated by legislative Democrats early in the session. The bill passed the Iowa House in March and passed the Iowa Senate this week. Governor Kim Reynolds, who last year vetoed a bill with a much higher THC limit, has signaled she supports the bill. If lawmakers wanted to smother the medical marijuana experiment with overbearing regulations, this would be the way to do it. The industry already is struggling to survive. State officials confirmed this week that Iowa Relief, one of only two cannabis manufacturers in the state, has relinquished its license after less than a year in operation. In March, dispensaries in Council Bluffs and Davenport closed, leaving patients with just three locations statewide. This editorial board and many other advocates have said so repeatedly, but it's worth saying again. If you take away people's medicine, they either will suffer or find illegal ways to get it, such as the free state of Illinois right next door. Iowa might as well put up, quote, closed for business, unquote, signs on the borders, and Illinois could post marijuana sales this way signs directing patients across the Mississippi River. Iowa is well behind the nation on this issue. Most states have real medical cannabis programs, giving patients access to whole plant medicine. They're in blue, purple, and red states. Many jurisdictions allow patients to grow their own marijuana plants. Some of these laws have been in place for more than 20 years. If legalizing medical marijuana was going to lead to some great public health crisis, as Iowa Republican apparently fear, it would have happened already. That's today's Gazette editorial. And we have one community letter submitted by Jeanette Schroeder of Cedar Rapids. COVID-19 continues amid confusion. Has someone declared that the pandemic is over? Is substantial spread done? Everything seems to be going back to normal. Some bars in Cedar Rapids have customers without masks lining up along their bars side by side in bar stools. People are attending outdoor prayer services within 6 feet of one another with no masks. Businesses, including Tyson processing plants, are returning to pre-COVID policies, including punishing workers for not going to work when they are sick. Citizens have been given such mixed messages from our state and national leaders that it's difficult to know what actions can be taken to prevent further spread of COVID-19. I keep hearing that people need to be responsible and follow safety precautions such as social distancing and staying home if sick, but they may not be able to choose to protect themselves and their loved ones unless there are interventions from government officials. The governor says that we have to protect our lives and the livelihood of people in Iowa. It appears she is choosing to protect livelihood over lives. Promoting the general welfare, one of the basic functions of government, does include both lives and livelihood. Can we trust government policies will truly protect both? That's the letter suggested by submitted by Janet Schroeder of Cedar Rapids. And we have a guest column by Diana Oldham, who is a retired teacher in St. John's, Michigan. This column was produced for the Progressive Media Project. And the title of the column is Indigenous Women Deserve Dignity, Justice. On June 3rd, the Canadian Broadcasting System reported little progress had been made on recommendations in a report released 1 year earlier from the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women. It was one more reminder that this problem never has received a serious response. In 2016 alone, according to one tally, more than 5,700 women, Native women, vanished or perished in violent ways. Amanda Cook was a 14-year-old girl who just wanted to have a fun time at the fair in Rossburn, Manitoba. 4 days later, on July 23, 1996, she was found dead, having been beaten to death. Her accused killer was found not guilty. Police found Ada Elaine Brown's body in a hotel room in Prince George, British Columbia, in 2001. They claim she died from natural causes despite evidence of assault. Jesse Renee Waters was beaten and murdered in South Dakota in 2015, but her suspected killer never was charged. Darlinda Ritchie, 26, and Karen Baker, 20, were found in a shallow grave in British Columbia in 1986. Their accused killer initially was convicted, later acquitted. This is just part of a larger pattern of violence. The National Institute of Justice reported that 84% of Native women have experienced violence, more than any other racial group in the United States and Canada. In fact, Indigenous women are killed at a rate 10 times higher than the U.S. average. Indigenous women have long been oppressed and silenced. They have been raped, enslaved, forcefully moved to reservations, and pushed into obscurity. Part of this goes back to the residential schools meant to further colonize Native Americans. While the last such school closed in 1996, the damage lingers. The students in these schools were taught that their people didn't belong to a civilization. Their hair was cut, they were forced to wear uniforms, and they were forbidden to speak their native languages. Many died because of poor medical attention and a lack of food. Sometimes their parents were not even notified. In addition to having their culture almost completely erased, Native women are arrested at a disproportionate rate. For example, 44% of Canada's female juvenile detention population was Indigenous, despite making up a tiny 6% of the entire female population, according to the Native Women's Association of Canada. Native children are disproportionately placed in foster homes, often to non-Native families. For every 1 million Native Americans, an average of 2.9 of them died annually from 1999 to 2015 as a result of legal intervention, CNN reported in 2017. It goes on, that mortality rate is 12% higher than for African Americans and three times the rate of whites. It also is incredibly difficult to get justice on reservations. If an outsider commits a crime, they probably never will be charged. This leaves many rapists and thieves from outside to roam free, while Native women and men are left scarred and emotionally ruined. Ever since its Anglo-Saxon founding, the self-proclaimed Americans have victimized Indigenous people again and again. The problem is that many have the view that this problem has been resolved. It obviously continues. That was the guest column by Diana Oldham, a retired teacher in St. John's, Michigan. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, June 13th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. And among our other notices from Edgewood, Delphina Marie Schuster, 90, and formerly of Dyersville, died Thursday, June 11, the Kramer Funeral Home, Dyersville. From Garnavillo, Charles Robert Breeze, 76, died Friday, June 12, the Took Allen Funeral Home, Guttenberg. From Iowa City, Charles Clarahan, 86, died Thursday, June 11, Lansing Funeral and Cremation Service, Iowa City. From Keystone, Edna Heitman, 98, died Friday, June 12, the Phillips Funeral Homes, Keystone. From Allwine, Robert Gary Estraskel, 78, died Friday, June 12, Jameson Schmitz Funeral Home, Allwine. And from Tipton, Jennifer Irene Johnson, 38, died Friday, June 12, Fry Funeral Home, Tipton. And among our regular notices, from Albernette, Shirley Dean Blake Millard, 81, died on Thursday, June 11, after an extended illness. In Iowa, a visitation only will be held from 1 to 3 p.m. on Sunday, June 14, at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. Be mindful of social distancing guidelines, and the request is that you provide your own face mask. A funeral service will be held at Latham Funeral Home in Elkton, Kentucky, at a later date, with interment at Cedar Grove Cemetery. Memorials, a memory may be shared of Shirley Dean Blake Millard at MurdochFuneralHome.com. From Anamosa, Marjorie Mae Johnson DeSoto. She was 83 and formerly of Anamosa, died Monday, June 8 in Mission, Texas. Services will be private at Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories by the Reverend Nick March. Burial Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery and Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. A memorial fund has been established in memory of Marjorie Mae Johnson DeSoto for Camp Courageous in Monticello, Iowa. From Cedar Rapids, Rose Helen Weiniger, 102, passed away Friday, June 12, at Hiawatha Care Center. Graveside services will be held Monday, June 15, at 10 a.m. at Cedar Memorial Park. Visitation at 9:30 a.m. at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. Online condolences, cedarmemorial.com. From Iowa City, Kathleen A., known as Kathy Fountain, 81, longtime resident of the area, died Thursday, June 11, at Briarwood Care Center, Iowa City. Funeral services, 10 a.m. Saturday, June 20, St. Mark's United Methodist Church, Iowa City. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday at Gay and Sia Funeral and Cremation Service. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations can be made in her memory to Eastern Iowa Alzheimer's Association. Complete obituary or share a thought, memory, or condolence, you can visit the funeral home website, gayandsia.com. From Iowa City, Lois Marie Matthews, 62, passed away unexpectedly Thursday, June 11, at UIHC. The family will celebrate the life of Lois by greeting her friends on Monday, June 15, from noon to 2 p.m. at Lansing Funeral and Cremation Service, Iowa City. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the Iowa City Library Friends Foundation. They have a website, icpl.org. Condolences may be sent to the family of Lois Marie Matthews at lensingfuneral.com. From Iowa City, Michael D. Russell, longtime resident of Iowa City, passed away Thursday, June 11, after a year and a half struggle with pancreatic cancer. Private graveside services are being planned at Ridgewood Cemetery in North Liberty, with military honors rendered. A time to toast Mike's life will be announced at a later date to be held at the Hilltop. Memorials can be donated to the Isaac Walton League in his honor. You can share a thought, memory, or condolence for Michael D. Russell at the funeral home website, gayandsia.com. From Silsby, Texas, Charles Albert Lewis, 76, he was known as Lou, died on Friday, June 5. A memorial service to celebrate Charles's life will be held at 2 p.m. Saturday, June 13, at 2770 Green Acres Road in Silsby. Garber, Leslie Lee Groth, 78, passed away on Wednesday, June 10, at his residence. Online condolences may be sent to LeonardMullerFuneralHome.com. Funeral service, 10:30 a.m. Monday, June 15, at the former Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Elkport, with Pastor Ronald Waterman officiating. Visitation, 2 to 6 p.m. Sunday, June 14, at Leonard Muller Funeral Home in Edgewood. Friends also may call 1 hour before the service at the church on Monday. Interment, Mount Harmony Cemetery, rural Garber. From Solon, Quinn A. Fields, 27, passed away Tuesday, June 9, at Mercy Hospital, Iowa City. Public graveside service will be held at 1 p.m. Tuesday, June 16, at Smithtown Cemetery, rural Lost Nation. Family and close friends are invited on Tuesday to attend a visitation at Dawson Funeral Services in Maquoketa, starting at 10:30 a.m. Memorials in memory of Quinn A. Fields of Solon may be directed to his family in his honor. Online condolences for the family, DawsonFuneral.com. From Waukon, Gene M. Leiden, 80, died Tuesday, June 2nd, at Chandler Regional Medical Center in Chandler, Arizona. Graveside services will be held on Saturday, June 13, at 11 a.m. at Mount Olivet Cemetery in Waukon, with Father Mark Osterhaus officiating. Martin Funeral Home in Waukon handled arrangements, and condolences may be sent to Mary A. Meyer at 1232 Joseph Lane, Waukon, Iowa, 52172. Condolences may be left at martinfunerals.com. And those are today's obituaries. We turn to the sports page for a story by K.A. Pilcher. West's Morgan excels on the diamond. Don't ask Marcus Morgan to pick a favorite sport. The calendar will likely dictate his choice. Football takes over during the fall, giving way to basketball in winter. Baseball rules the spring and summer for the Iowa City West Junior, said Morgan, a quarterback who has received multiple NCAA Division I scholarship offers for football and baseball. I've grown up playing all three sports since I was really small. I've made really good memories and bonds through each of those sports. I wouldn't say there's a front runner right now as far as my favorite. I really enjoy playing all three. Morgan has thrived in each of the Trojans, earning all state honors as a sophomore a year ago. He will attempt to build on that success and power West after a trip to the state semifinals last season. As Stump said, he's just mentally strong to be able to do that, go place to place and excel in all the sports. We saw it in baseball last year in the tournaments. That was when he was absolute best. Every game was close, and he just was a warrior out there. He has great composure and toughness. He takes that to all the sports. Statistics indicates Morgan's dominance last season. He posted a 10-0 record with a 0.71 earned run average, Fanning 105 batters in just 59.3 innings pitched, a nice improvement from the 6-1 mark and 1.75 ERA as a freshman. Morgan attributes the growth to dedication in the weight room and being another year of maturation. Moore said, "Morgan, I got a lot stronger going into last season. I think that was a big part of it. Also, having that year of experience the season before, that as a freshman, having that varsity experience definitely helped. Helped me figure out what works and what doesn't. This season has already been strange. Normally, teams would be 3 weeks into competition after a full spring of training. Morgan prepared himself with lifting and throwing. Morgan used a friend's backyard mound for weekly bullpen sessions and added long toss workouts a few times a week. Tossing the football around helped keep his arm in shape as well." Morgan said, "Usually you can get in a nice little rhythm going into the postseason, getting things rolling and playing how you want to play. With the short season, you really don't know what's going to happen. You have to find that rhythm early and hopefully take it into the postseason." The 6'3", 190-pound right-hander possesses a fastball that hit 86 to 88 miles per hour. He has good command of breaking pitches, stifling batters. The key is to get ahead in the count and use his full arsenal. Morgan said, "That is where my off-speed slider and sweeping curve comes into play. That's my favorite pitch to throw. Just having really good command on that and locating it where I need it to be." Stumpf highlighted a couple defining moments last season. Morgan showed his poise in a regular season battle against Iowa City High, overcoming early adversity and keeping West in a game won in 8 innings. He demonstrated grit when he was 100% physically, pitching 4 innings against Dubuque Senior for a depleted staff after a doubleheader sweep against highly ranked Western Dubuque. Morgan shined in the postseason, helping escort the Trojans to the Class 4A state semifinal. He pitched in each of the first 3 games. Morgan posted a 15-strikeout complete game, 2-hitter against Muscatine, and struck out 13 in a 1-hitter against Prairie in consecutive 2-1 sub-state victories. In durable Ironman fashion, he rebounded for 11 strikeouts in 5 2/3 innings in a state quarterfinal victory over Pleasant Valley. Stump said, he just kept getting better. I think the tournament games is where he put it all together. He was a dynamite in that part. During the regular season, he saw mental growth. For the tournament, he put the whole package together. We hope he keeps building off that. Stump hesitates to talk potential, but admits Morgan has blossomed sooner than some other West pitchers, like Ole Miss receiver Austin Miller and former Iowa thrower Nick Gallagher. Stump said, "We've had some really outstanding pitchers. Marcus has all that stuff, and he's got high echelon stuff. He has all the other things my guys didn't have before." And there's a picture of the player mentioned on the front page. Also on the sports page, National High School Helmet Tournament kicks off today, reported by Jeff Johnson. They have their own Twitter page. That's how big time this thing has become. Maquoketa Valley football coach activities director Trevor Arnold is one of 7 guys from around the country who have made it their quest to find out which high school football program has the best helmet. Online voting via Twitter has begun for what they are terming the National High School Helmet Tournament. A champion will be determined at the end of this month, with a trophy being awarded and everything. It's at Helmet Tourney, by the way. As of Friday afternoon, there were more than 3,200 followers. Arnold said, when asked his level of surprise at the popularity of his endeavor, "I don't think that I'm shocked. I'd like to think I have a pretty good pulse for how people react and think about high school sports in general. A helmet is such a signifying thing for a program. You think of college helmets, everybody knows what a school's helmet looks like. Everybody knows what a Hawkeye helmet looks like. You know what I mean? Everybody knows about a high school's helmet in their own state. Then when you broaden it out, take an Iowa high school helmet in terms of the entire country, you find out real quick how unique or not unique of a helmet you actually have. After hearing about a Twitter tournament in another state, Arnold decided to pass idle time during the COVID-19 pandemic by putting together an Iowa tourney a couple of months ago, asking schools to provide him photos of their helmets. Arnold put together a 128 school bracket with the head-to-head event won by Council Bluffs Lewis Central. Many other states have since followed suit. Arnold said 46 of them are represented in the national event, which already has begun with wild card entries facing off against each other. Those were determined by the tournament committee that consists of Arnold and other coaches from Nebraska, Montana, Illinois, Pennsylvania, Missouri, and Kansas. The only states not participating are Oklahoma, Connecticut, Nevada, and Mississippi. Arnold hopes that will change next year. The 46 state champs automatically qualified for what will be a 64 school bracket. Arnold and his committee picked four at-large schools from each state who are going head-to-head right now, with 18 of those eventually fit into the final random bracket. In Iowa, the wild cards are Otebolt, Arthur, Battle Creek, Ida Grove, Underwood Trainer, and North Fayette County Valley. Two of the more interesting at-large helmets nationally are the Camas, Washington Papermakers and the Chinook, Montana Sugar Beaters. Those were just cool, unique things that people like to look at. So those are helmets we wanted to get into the mix, Arnold said. Then we also want to consider if these schools have a following. Do they use Twitter very well? Do they have very many followers? Do they know how to rally support? The 64 school tournament begins today. All matchups have a 24-hour voting time frame, with 48 hours being allowed once it gets to the Elite Eight. The championship head-to-head will be June 29 and 30. For those thinking about fixing the results, yes, the 7-coach committee is aware you can buy a certain amount of votes on Twitter for a small fee. Someone checks the authenticity of the vote virtually every single hour. Arnold said, as a group, we have seen over 6,500 helmets. That's what we figured out. Mark McLaughlin from Nebraska, he's a spreadsheet guru and had them all on there. That's kind of comical. The article is accompanied by a picture of one of the helmets, the Williamsport, Pennsylvania Millionaires, and the logo is a top hat, white gloves, and cane. Sports columnist K.J. Pilcher has listed the high school baseball 2020 players and teams to watch. So among the players from Western Dubuque, Calvin Harris. From Iowa City West, Marcus Morgan. From Iowa City Liberty, Nolan Fry. From Marion, Gage Frank. From Linmar, Coy Sarsfield. From Cedar Rapids Kennedy, Mason Bain. From South Winneshiek, Noah Teekscotter. From Alburnett, two people from Alburnett, both we have Reed Stallman and Hunter Caves. From North Lynn, Austin Hilmer. Cedar Rapids Jefferson, Dylan McVeigh. From Cedar Rapids Xavier, Nick Banowitz. From West Branch, Matt Paulson. From Iowa City Regina, Chase Becker. From HLV, Brody Wolf. And from Cedar Rapids Prairie, Carson Siroi. And the teams to watch for this coming baseball season: Alburnett, Cedar Rapids Xavier, Iowa City West, Marion, North Lynn, South Winneshiek, West Branch, and Western Dubuque. Those are the teams and players to watch during this upcoming high school baseball season. And we return to the front section on page 10, or no, this is page 10. Large Iowa City protests led to 15 people charged. This is reported by Lee Hermiston. Large demonstrations across Iowa City this month resulted in 15 people facing charges and 7 arrests, according to city data. The Iowa City Council is scheduled to hold a special formal meeting Tuesday to discuss the 12 demands of the Iowa Freedom Riders, a group representing the interests of the Black Lives Matter movement in Iowa City. Among those demands is the city dropping all charges, including citations and tickets, against protesters. While the City Council, during its Tuesday work session, expressed a willingness to consider that request, there were two issues. One, a majority of the council wished to see a list of the charges before calling for them to be dropped. Second, charging decisions are made by the Johnson County Attorney's Office. To that end, included in an 87-page information packet related to Tuesday's meeting is a list of charges for the council to review. City Manager Jeff Fruin and City Attorney Eleanor Dilks noted that only 3 speeding and stop sign charges are under the city's discretion. The rest will be prosecuted by the Johnson County Attorney's Office. The memo reads, the council can make a request to drop charges, and then, but city staff does not make a recommendation to do so. Information provided by the city shows charges were filed against 15 people between May 30 and early June 9, proximal to demonstration locations, dates, and times. Of those, 7 people were arrested, but 2 of them were cited and released. An arrest is pending for 1 person facing a drunken driving charge. Charges include unlawful assembly, failure to disperse, disorderly conduct, possession of drug paraphernalia, drunken driving, possession of firearms under the influence, and various traffic violations. Only 2 people had their vehicles impounded, according to the city's data. 10 of the people charged list Iowa City addresses. 1 person is from North Liberty, 1 is from Cedar Rapids, and 3 live outside the corridor. 7 of the arrests and citations appear to be a result of 50 traffic stops made by officers near the protests. More than 70% of those traffic stops, 37, resulted only in warnings. And we'll close it out with a look at the Living page, a large article, Second Chance. Iowa Rescue Group helps save 1,000 birds from farms struggling during coronavirus pandemic, reported by Allison Gowans. On a rural property outside Springville, 4 chickens are living their best life this summer. They were almost part of a mass culling of birds from a farm near Fort Dodge. The farmer, who wished to remain anonymous, reached out to animal rescue groups when he was faced with a tough decision. Due to financial difficulties related to the coronavirus, he needed to reduce the size of his flock of egg-laying hens by more than 100,000 birds. The California organization Animal Place answered the call. A donor paid to fly chartered planes from California to Iowa, and a group of volunteers went one morning in mid-May to take as many chickens as they could. Allison Stone, who runs Hercules Haven Farm Rescue near Springville, went to help along with her daughter Issy and Hercules Haven Animal Coordinator Sarah Krambeck. Stone said of the rescue effort, "It was impressive. We stayed at a hotel and got up at 3 a.m. to get to the farm at 4 a.m. The Stones and other volunteers spent hours pulling out chickens, putting them into crates that could be flown back to California. A few farm sanctuaries in Iowa also took in a handful of birds. Hercules Haven took 4. Stone said she wishes she could help more animals, but her organization is pretty much at capacity. She and her husband started the nonprofit in Cedar Rapids in 2017 and moved to a property with 40 acres in Springville in 2019. Even with the space they gained from that move, they can feed and care for only so many animals with just their family and a small group of volunteers. In addition to a flock of chickens, they have pigs, sheep, goats, and horses." Stone said the farmer told her it was costing him more to feed the chickens than he was making selling their eggs. The Fort Dodge farmer is not alone in making the decision to cull his animals during the pandemic. When schools closed and demand from restaurants and commercial kitchens dropped, many producers were not able to quickly pivot to selling to grocery stores with different supply chains and packaging requirements. The article continues, but there is a picture of Haley Dixon helped climb up to the fourth tier of hen cages to pull them out during a rescue effort in May at the farm near Fort Dodge. There's also a picture of some of the cages being loaded into the airplane, as mentioned in the article. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for this Saturday, June 13th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.